This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we ask the question, is Donald Trump barred from serving as president again?
Constitutional scholar Stephen Rohde joins us to discuss whether the lawsuits invoking Section 3 of the 14th Amendment will prevent Trump from running again.
We will also examine the renewed militancy on the part of the labor movement in the United States.
We'll speak with Al Bradbury, the editor of Labor Notes, an organization that's attempting to put movement back into the labor movement.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court became the most conservative it has been in 90 years, with conservative justices controlling decisions with a comfortable 6-3 majority. So we can no longer take any constitutional rights or liberties we thought we had for granted. Prior Supreme Court rulings that aimed at ensuring fairness, equal opportunity, reproductive freedom, and a participatory government, including for those who were not born into the favored elite classes, are now at great risk. Today, with the help of Stephen Rohde, our favorite constitutional scholar, as our guest, we examine two very important constitutional issues. First, the question of how safe is freedom of the press in our country today? We do this by looking at the new challenges being leveled at the landmark 1964 case, New York Times versus Sullivan, a case granting protection to a newspaper when it prints a libelous story about a public official or public figure, but does so without actual malice. Is that press protection about to disappear? And then we change gears and ask our guest about the currently much discussed question, flowing from the fact that former President Donald Trump now faces criminal charges for seeking to overturn the 2020 presidential election. The question stemming from this is, does Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to our Constitution, stating that any American official who takes an oath to uphold the Constitution is disqualified from holding any future office if they, and I quote, engage in insurrection or rebellion or provide aid and comfort to our enemies, does that mean that Trump is now disqualified from becoming president again? The Constitution does not spell out how to enforce that ban. It was applied 8 times in the late 1800s. Today, a number of state attorneys general and others are contemplating this question and in a few cases preparing to take the matter to court, given their belief that Trump should now, because of his actions on and around the January 6th insurrection, be disqualified from holding any future office. In fact, a lawsuit has now been filed by 6 Republican primary voters in Colorado asking just that question and seeking to bar Donald Trump from that primary or otherwise running for president based on his disqualifications under that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Well, we will ask our guest about both of these matters. Our guest is, of course, as I said, Stephen Rohde. Stephen Rohde recently published a fabulous review of a new book by Samantha Barbas entitled Actual Malice, Civil Rights and Freedom of the Press in New York versus Sullivan. Steve Rohde is a writer, a lecturer, a political activist who practiced civil rights and civil liberties law and intellectual property law for almost 50 years. He is past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and a co-founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, while also playing a leadership role in many other organizations. He writes book reviews for the Los Angeles Review of Books, Ms. Magazine, and TruthDig.org, and his articles appear regularly in many other online publications. So Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, guys, and it's so good to be discussing two of the most important constitutional conflicts facing us right now.
Oh, absolutely. And let's start off with the free press issue. In the book that you've recently reviewed, Actual Malice, Civil Rights and Freedom of the Press in New York versus Sullivan, written by Samantha Barbas, makes the case, really, that the New York Times versus Sullivan case was, well, just as important to changing the course of the civil rights movement as it was to freedom of speech. Can you briefly tell us why that was so?
Yes, this has been largely overlooked by some, that this crucial First Amendment decision arose in the context of the turbulent civil rights movement. This was a period in which segregationists had discovered a new weapon to both silence the press coverage of civil rights and to punish leaders of the civil rights movement itself. That weapon was libel law. Remarkably, numerous lawsuits were filed in the South in this period. By 1964, officials in three southern states had brought over 17 libel actions against various parties, primarily over civil rights coverage, seeking a whopping $288 million in damages by today's dollars and an astounding $2.9 billion. Libel law then was very simple. It had not been constitutionalized. A plaintiff, even a public official or public figure, need only prove that a false statement was made of and concerning that person. The statements were presumed to be false under the existing law, and it would be up to the defendant, to the newspaper or otherwise, to prove that everything was true in all particulars. This was a serious weapon. It was being used to silence the civil rights movement, and it set the stage for this case.
Stephen Rohde, who were the parties in the New York Times lawsuit, and what claims and legal arguments were they bringing to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, in this turbulent period, Martin Luther King and his allies needed to raise money for bail money to support their campaigns throughout the South, and several supporters took out a full-page ad in the New York Times pleading for support and calling out the segregationists and their racist activities. So on March 25, 1960, the full-page ad, Heed Their Rising Voices, was published in the New York Times. It was a stirring and exciting ad, but unfortunately, it had several minor errors. In the zeal to publish it and the urgency, the campaign made some mistakes. They had the students singing a different song when they were protesting. It said that the police came to Alabama State College to prevent demonstrators, but they never circled or ringed the campus. And the most serious in the ad was that authorities padlocked the student dining hall. It wasn't padlocked. Officials never attempted to starve the students into submission. Down in Alabama, where only roughly 300 copies of the New York Times was even published and sold, a commissioner of police, L.B. Sullivan, got wind of the ad. He wasn't named in the ad, but he took offense as one of the, quote, authorities accused in the ad. And he went to a local libel lawyer. They read the law. They filed a lawsuit. They brought the New York Times to court, plus they named four black ministers who had signed the ad. On April 19, 1960, the suit was filed, and by November of 1960, they were in trial. It was an all-white jury in front of a racist judge, and lo and behold, the verdict was for $500,000, exactly what Sullivan had asked for. The Times was now facing a huge verdict. They had to pull their reporters from Alabama. and limit the coverage of the civil rights movement, but it set the stage for the case going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Please, Steve, though, explain to us as well how that decision in New York Times versus Sullivan by the Supreme Court, how its legacy has shaped our current view of freedom of the press, making it such an important case.
Yes. The New York Times hired Herbert Wexler, a professor at Columbia Law School, and I am proud to say that I had Herbert Wexler for constitutional law when I went to Columbia Law School. He was an extraordinary teacher. In this case, he constitutionalized libel. He conceived of an argument to appeal to the Supreme Court that this wasn't about reputation and traditional defamation concepts. In the case of public officials, the law was allowing you to sue for slandering the government. This was seditious libel, something used in the colonial period in the Alien and Sedition Act, but which had been overcome by Thomas Jefferson and later cases. But now it was allowed to be used by individual plaintiffs. He went to the court. He argued for an absolute privilege that even if slight mistakes are made and there are false statements, if they should be protected because public officials have a forum, they can answer the charges in the public media. And he went before the United States Supreme Court. On March 9, 1964, Justice William Brennan, one of my heroes on the court, announced a unanimous opinion, gathering all of the justices to overturn the verdict against the New York Times and the four ministers. It reversed 200 years of American law and said that a libel action brought by a public official could not stand unless that official could prove that the publication knew that it was publishing falsehoods or acted in reckless disregard of the truth. There's a famous quote worth quoting today by Justice Brennan. Quote, "Thus we consider this case against the background of a profound national commitment to the principle that debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and that it may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials." New York Times went into the law books. It's been cited over 60 times in Supreme Court opinions. Dr. King himself applauded the court for upholding, quote, "the freedom of the press and speech, so vital to those who are engaged in the struggle for full freedom."
Given the current makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, is the holding of New York Times versus Sullivan at risk? And if so, how might this impact freedom of the press?
We're in a very dangerous moment when it comes to freedom of the press in this country for so many reasons. And one of them is a concerted effort to reverse New York Times against Sullivan. In 2019, Justice Clarence Thomas argued for a reassessment. Gee, why would a Supreme Court justice worry about public scrutiny of his role on the Supreme Court and want to have broader libel laws? In 2021, Neil Gorsuch on the court claimed that he was reassessing New York Times against Sullivan and believed it gave too much protection to the press. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has complained about the Sullivan case, that it serves as a shield to protect publications that smear officials and candidates. That's an echo, by the way, of things that former President Donald Trump said as well. DeSantis has proposed a bill that would leave the press wide open to lawsuits, including a rule that comments made by an anonymous source, which is really a common journalistic technique, would be presumed false in defamation suits. So there are serious threats to Sullivan, but I do want to add that when the shoe is on the other foot, right-wing press is only too eager to take advantage of New York Times against Sullivan. But that was shown in the $1.6 billion libel case that Dominion Voting Systems brought against Fox News. When Fox News was sued for defamation, what did they raise in their defense? New York Times against Sullivan. But when enough evidence was shown that there was knowledge of falsity and reckless disregard, then they settled for $787 million. So it seems to me that segregationists tried to impede the civil rights movement in the past. Today, Republican politicians and conservative Supreme Court justices are seeking to eliminate Sullivan. The rest of us, through the ballot box, through our campaigning, through our activism, have to ensure that the press provides that uninhibited, robust, and wide-open freedom of the press that we depend on.
Well, this is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Maria Hall, and we're interviewing Steve Rohde here on Law & Disorder. And Steve, let's now, well, take a big turn and get your opinion on the highly controversial question having to do with whether a Section 3 of the 14th Amendment might disqualify or be available to disqualify Trump from running and serving as president again. In fact, just some days ago, the case of Anderson versus Griswold was filed by six voters in the Colorado primary. And it asked the question, is it clear that based on what Trump has done, that he is disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? So tell us about that case, about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Well, for a constitutional lawyer, after practicing almost 50 years, who would think that an obscure Section 3 of the 14th Amendment could change American history? In the post-Civil War period, the Union was very concerned about Confederate officials, former Confederate officials serving in government, and they wrote into the 14th Amendment a provision that any person who had sworn to uphold the U.S. Constitution, but then later, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or have given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, shall be disqualified from serving in federal or state office unless Congress, by a two-thirds vote, remove that disqualification. Now, what people need to understand in all the attention that's beginning to be paid to this is not punishment. It's a disqualification written into the U.S. Constitution. There are several qualifications to be president, 35 years old, a natural-born citizen, etc. So this provision has actually been used at least eight times that researchers have discovered, primarily during the civil rights period. But today, now legal scholars across the political spectrum, conservatives and liberals alike, have identified the fact that this provision can be applied to disqualify former President Trump. They've identified these eight prior cases, and the Congress knew what it was talking about when it spoke of enemies. This was not only foreign enemies. It was written at a time where the Confederates, former American citizens, were the enemies, and the congressional oath says enemies, foreign or domestic. Now, it's been applied more recently in our very era following the January 6th insurrection. Former New Mexico County Commissioner Coy Griffin was found by a state court to have engaged in insurrection sufficient to disqualify him from running for office. And now, as you mentioned, the organization Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics, which brought the successful New Mexico case, have now brought a case called Anderson versus Griswold for five Republican registered voters in the upcoming Republican primary. This is an extraordinary complaint, and I urge anyone to go to the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics website. The complaint is 115 pages, 452 paragraphs, 206 footnotes. That could sound intimidating, but it reads like a spy novel as it recounts what Trump has done to engage in insurrection and give aid and comfort to our enemies. I believe this case will work its way through the courts. I think it is a serious question of Trump's disqualification.
Stephen Rohde, would any lawsuit now seeking to get Trump disqualified under the 14th Amendment be deemed premature, given that Trump has not yet been found guilty of, quote, engaging in insurrection or rebellion, end quote, or aiding and abetting our enemies?
This is a popular myth currently being circulated by Trump, his lawyers, and others. A criminal conviction is not a prerequisite to disqualification. And we have all eight of those previous cases under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to prove that. It's a disqualification. You don't need a criminal conviction regarding your natural born status or any other status. So that's a myth. This has been enforced in civil courts by suing secretaries of state, as is the case in the Colorado case, or by various writ procedures. It does not go to a jury, and the court is able to consider all available evidence, which could include the report of the January 6th congressional investigation, which produced a 1,000-page report on these issues. All of those facts are considered, and the Secretary of State makes a decision.
Well, Steve, you've just made a compelling case for that, but from a political point of view, given that such a civil trial has not yet taken place, lawsuit's been filed, given that no trial has yet started, even though, as you say, it's not required, nor is any finding of verdict of guilty required, would not the American people think it was grossly unfair and undemocratic somehow to seek to use Section 3 of the 14th Amendment at this point in the game?
That's a very serious question and a serious problem the country faces. We've had two impeachments. We have four indictments. We have now a suit to disqualify him. I'm confident other suits will be brought. There are some who argue that the way to prevent Donald Trump from reoccupying the White House is to beat him at the poll. And I respect that view, and I think that ultimately may be how the American people must rise up and organize. But I also believe we are a country of laws, and the rule of law says, as it did with the two impeachments and with these four indictments, that to the extent he has, in those cases, broken the law, or to the extent he is constitutionally disqualified from running for president and serving as president, it is the duty of our system to raise those issues and to have them adjudicated in courts of law in this country. I come down on that side. I am concerned of the consequences if he is blocked from running for president. There are many, including himself, who are making inflammatory threats of what will happen, that January 6th was only a rehearsal. We have to gird our loins for that. We have to be prepared for that. But but I don't think that's a reason to allow a disqualified person to run for president.
This case, or these cases, will no likely, one or more of them, get to the U.S. Supreme Court. What do you suspect is likely to happen there?
This is such a quandary and such a risk to the Constitution and to American democracy. The premise is that one or more secretaries of state have disqualified Donald Trump from being on the ballot either in a primary or in the general election, that there is a factual record that has been built to establish that he engaged in insurrection or rebellion, or, and it's a separate provision, gave aid and comfort to our enemies. When you think about that term, without the qualifications for insurrection and rebellion, does any sentient human being believe that Donald Trump did not give aid and comfort to the enemies of the Constitution in the lead-up to January 6th and to all of his efforts to deny the lawful inauguration of Joe Biden? That is aid and comfort. He promised pardons. He gave well wishes. He provided all kinds of resources. So, if a record of that strength comes before the U.S. Supreme Court, are all six of those conservative justices going to blink? Is Chief Justice Roberts going down in infamy by joining a majority to find that Donald Trump is not disqualified? Is there any decency among those to provide two more votes with the liberal justices to provide a five-court majority to uphold Trump's disqualification? That will be a constitutional crisis when and if that case reaches the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, and I can assure our listeners we'll certainly be talking to you again about that if that does indeed happen. You've raised again some amazing questions of great importance. We thank you again for being here with us on Law and Disorder. As always, it's been a real pleasure to have you and be able to talk to you about these issues. One last thought, Steve Rohde, please let our listeners know where they can find your work, because there's many of your writings which I think they would like to be able to read.
Well, I'm very proud to be a contributor to the Los Angeles Review of Books, LARB. You can go on their website. I'm a contributor there. I write for Truth Dig and the LA Progressive, and a simple search will find my writings on these issues and others. I consider this a moment for me to be able to exercise my freedom of speech. You at Law and Disorder and elsewhere are very generous with your time. I believe that a public well-educated on these issues, these cannot be left to judges and lawyers. These are issues every person in America should understand and should act on, and it's always my privilege to be with both of you.
Well, thank you so much, and we double down, and I'm sure Maria and I agree with your last statement as well. Thank you, Steve Rohde, for joining us again here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. By giving you no time, instead of it all, but we cannot function, we can feel nothing at all. They hurt us at home, they beat us at school, and
Labor is the sleeping giant in American politics, but not so sleepy anymore. We're in the midst of a labor upsurge, one with promise of delivering not only better wages and working conditions, but the prospects of wider positive social change. There's a new fighting spirit in the land, expressed by this rise in labor militancy. We can look back 5 years ago to the beginning of the upsurges of teacher militancy in red states like West Virginia, Kentucky, Wyoming, and Arizona, where teachers struck, often illegally, to better not only their situation, but that of the communities they lived in. This upsurge has continued. Recently, we've seen the great success of the Amazon warehouse workers in Staten Island coming together to form a union, and the Starbucks workers across the country have done the same. Meanwhile, the writers and actors in Hollywood have been on strike for several months. The Democratic Party, which gets a lot of money from the entertainment industry, has not lifted a finger to help them. The captains of finance and industry run and control the Democratic Party. They make sure that Bernie Sanders did not get the nomination in 2016 or in 2020. The leadership of the labor movement most often supports the Democratic Party, explaining that they are the lesser of two evils. The late great journalist Glenn Ford called the Democratic Party the more effective of two evils. He would have cited as proof of this the Biden administration's recent intervention, which prevented the powerful railroad workers' union from going on strike this summer. To talk about labor's predicament and their fight back, we speak today with Al Bradbury. She's the editor of Labor Notes and an advocate and practitioner of labor militancy. Labor Notes is a media and organizational project since 1978 that has been the voice of union activists who want to put the movement back into the labor movement. Editor Al Bradbury joined the staff of Labor Notes in 2012 after working with hospital workers as a researcher and organizer for the Service Employees Local 49 in Oregon. Al Bradbury, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
Very, very briefly, before we get started, just tell our listeners, what is Labor Notes?
Yeah, Labor Notes has been around since 1979 and is the voice of workers who want to put the movement back in the labor movement. So we got started when there were reform currents in different unions, the auto workers, the Teamsters, the steel workers, the mine workers, people who are pushing for more democracy and militancy in their unions, to cohere that into a larger movement, a whole current within the labor movement. And over the years, we have conferences, trainings, books to share strategies, but Labor Notes is all about building a bottom-up labor movement that's built by the workers who are fighting in it.
Well, thank you. Al Bradbury, when I was growing up in the 50s, union membership was much higher than it is today. A third of the private sector was organized, and now it's only about 6%. How do you account for that?
In some ways, that was an unusual window of that period in the 50s. There had been a burst of organizing in the 30s and tons of strikes. The most workers in U.S. history to go on strike in a single year was in 1946, right after the war. And there was this short post-war period when there was a sort of bargain struck between labor and capital. Productivity was booming. There was a lot to go around. And employers had been experiencing all these strikes, all this organizing upheaval, unwanted labor peace. And then there was a public sector organizing and strike wave a little later in the 60s and 70s. But right around 1980, the employers launched an offensive. Essentially, they decided to fight unions. And it was right around then that Chrysler asked for concessions, asked for, you know, a contract that was worse than the previous one for the first time. And many companies took that signal and did the same. Reagan famously broke a strike of air traffic controllers, is often cited as ushering in an era of anti-union attacks. Like, here's a message from the president on down. And you know, we have a huge industry of anti-union consultants that employers hire to figure out how to fight union drives, how to scare and divide people. So essentially, it's because the employers went on the offensive. And obviously, globalization played a role, too, as they figured out they could move more work around, sort of play workers off against each other. It's the employer's fault. But we also have to reckon with unions' failures to figure out how to respond to that. You know, capital gonna capital. Like, of course the employers are fighting us. You can't deny that unions failed to to respond effectively, to figure out how to organize new employers and sectors. Over time, you know, many of our unions, I think, got too cozy with the boss and distant from the shop floor, sort of accepted this role as an intermediary organization that was there to keep peace between labor and management rather than to really lead the fight against management, even though management was, you know, increasingly going on the fight against workers. And so that's part of why, you know, Labor Notes has stood for, we've got to build more of a fight. We've got to, you know, transform our unions to take on the challenges of an increasingly hostile and powerful management, and, you know, figure out how to build up a stronger labor movement again.
Well, Al Bradbury, Jim Lafferty here. Yeah, and that seems to be happening a bit. That's what I wanted to ask you about next. Certainly in the last few years, teachers' union strikes, other strikes we're going to be talking about in this show today, there seems to be an increased militancy again. Public opinion polls show that certainly most Americans have a positive view, I think, of unions. But how do you account for this kind of, if I may call it that, renewed militancy and toughness on the part of the workers and the unions?
Yes, I see that too. It's an exciting time and in some ways a hopeful time in labor. I will say people have, by and large, had a positive view of unions for a long time. I think for decades, surveys have been showing something like a majority of workers, 60% or more of workers, wanted a union in their workplace. The trouble was getting it. I worked as a union organizer helping people form a union, and certainly that bears out that, you know, you run into some people who maybe don't want a union, but most people do. They want to improve their workplace. They want more power. They want better wages. They want more safety. They're frustrated with the oppressive way that their boss behaves. The bigger obstacles are fear that if you try to organize, you'll get fired, and hopelessness, the sense that, like, it's, we don't have any power anyway. It's just too big a task. There's nothing we can do. And so I think in the current moment, we're seeing some change to that. People are less afraid, partly because we're in a tight labor market. People see accurately that the boss needs you more than you need them. It's not as hard to get another job. You know, it's harder for the boss to fire you because they really need you. And it's less of a risk because, you know, there are many other employers out there searching. So people are getting bolder for, you know, because they're assessing the situation accurately. And people are more encouraged. There's a sort of virtuous cycle that builds on itself, that when you see other people exercising their power, you see somebody organizing a union or going on strike and getting something from it, that does give you a sense of confidence that maybe it will work. And so I think as we've begun to see some resurgence, you see people across sectors being inspired by union drives elsewhere, wanting to do the same, and it builds on itself. That's an exciting thing about the moment we're in, and that kind of cross-pollination is what things like Labor Notes conferences and events are about, to encourage that.
Al Bradbury, last month, the 340,000-strong Teamsters Union settled with United Parcel Service, UPS, just prior to a threatened, well-prepared strike. They won significant wage increases, abolition of the two-tier wage system, and thousands of new full-time jobs for their members. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, you really put your finger on it, that it was the threat of a well-prepared strike that is what enabled them to win so much. It really was such a clear demonstration of the power that workers have, the tremendous leverage that workers have, that when over a period of months of organizing and activity, the union made clear that members were really prepared to walk out. Wall Street freaked out, the business press freaked out, UPS as an employer did and gave in and forked over a lot more money than it had been willing to, you know, earlier in negotiations, because it didn't want to see a strike. And it's, you know, I love to see that, to demonstrate that, like, we're not as powerless as we might feel when we act in unison. Capital really needs us. The backstory to that, how they got there, involves a grassroots movement in the union, a bottom-up movement over a number of years to change the union's approach. They really had a sort of go-along-to-get-along administration in that union for decades, but a reform movement of rank-and-file Teamsters that built over years to push for a different kind of union, to push for, to say, we need to threaten a strike. That's the only way we're going to undo some of these concessions, and we shouldn't make any more concessions, and we need to, you know, put overturning them on the table and make it a theme. People, so over a period of time when Teamsters voted voted down bad contracts. The previous deal in 2018 was rejected by a majority of members, but the leadership exploited a loophole in their constitution to force it on people anyway. But people were really mad about that, and that propelled a reform slate into power. So a new leadership won in the union for the first time in decades, and with a really different mandate. We could clearly, you know, riding the momentum of people saying, we got to reverse those concessions, we don't want any more concessions, we're not afraid to strike. So having a leadership that was setting a different tone, but even more important than that, was the bottom-up organizing that had propelled that win, but that continued to fuel that contract campaign. So it really took thousands of conversations and actions at different UPS hubs around the country to make that strike threat real, to get coworkers ready to strike, and to, you know, show UPS that they'd better hand over some more of their millions if they wanted to avoid it.
Yeah, and now we have poised and ready to strike, of course, on September 14th. 150,000 strong United Auto Workers Union. As an old Detroit boy and lawyer from Detroit, I know about the UAW and very much appreciate what they're about. Really, they have members in Canada as well. It's against the big three auto manufacturers if the strike does take place, of course. Now, those auto manufacturing companies, after all, have closed, well, 65 plants in the last, 20 years. And as your organization, Labor Notes associate editor, Luis León, reports, and I quote, "The UAW top leadership and membership are in a fighting mood, the likes of which the UAW hasn't seen in decades," close quote. Well, talk to us about this.
Yes, and Luis Feliz León has been doing tremendous reporting. I would encourage, you know, anyone interested to follow him and, you know, read as much more detailed reports than we'll have time for today. But it's true. Auto workers are in a fighting mood, like workers around the country. And we talked a little at the top of the show about this changing mood around the country. There's anger over the pandemic. Many workers were, you know, pushed to take much greater risks on the job and also to work longer hours, speed up intensification of work during the pandemic while their employers made more money than ever and demonstrated a lack of concern about workers' safety. And I think, you know, across sectors, people are mad about that. And certainly auto workers are mad about that. There's also this confidence boost from the tight labor market. And there's a lot about current working conditions that makes people angrier than ever, too. The flip side of a tight labor market is employers are pushing everyone on productivity, longer hours, faster work, intensification of work. In the auto workers, as in the Teamsters, there's a union reform backstory to this. Reformers won a couple years ago the right to direct election of top officers of the union, something they'd never had before. It used to be that locals elected people to a convention, and then the convention elected the leadership. Now it's, you know, one member, one vote. And then the reformers won the election. So there's a new leadership after 80 years of control of, you know, really one-party rule in the United Auto Workers by the administration caucus, which is very entrenched leadership. There's a different and much more militant leadership that won the election a few months ago, the UAW Members United slate and President Sean Fain. And part of what, you know, opened the opportunity for that change was this corruption scandal that came out. It turns out that this succession of leaders of the administration caucus had been, you know, engaging in a disgusting culture of spending both union and employer money on themselves and their family, you know, a really direct, sort of the worst thing. But the problems of administration caucus rule also go much deeper than that. The problems were not just the people were, you know, enriching themselves and using union funds to stay in power, but that they were accepting concessions, you know, starting in the 80s and then in the 2008-2009 financial crisis, accepting this tiered system where new hires would make only half as much as existing workers. And they never totally got that back. They reduced the gap a couple contracts ago amid a member rebellion after workers voted down a contract at Chrysler and they had to go back and do better. But people are mad about that. There's these tiers, and we see them in many sectors where people are doing the same job alongside one another at different wages, it's just wrong, and it makes people very angry, you know, for all the right reasons. It's obviously bad for the new hires who are making less. It's not fair. It's bad for the existing workers who are making more, but now you have a target on your back. Why would the employer want to keep you around when they can pay someone else less to do it? And it's bad for the union. It creates division and resentment, and our power as a union is our unity and our solidarity. So tears are a union killer, ultimately. So it's very heartening to see in the auto workers and elsewhere, you know, a lot of resistance in recent years where people are saying, no, let's put these tiers to an end, equal pay for equal work. They're still the second-tier workers currently. They don't get any retiree health care. They don't get any pension. So one of the big demands is to get rid of those tiers. Among the other big demands are, you know, job security is always an issue, but particularly now as the auto industry is shifting in a big way from gas-powered to electric vehicles, the union wants to make sure this transition doesn't displace the existing workforce, that union members have a first shot at these jobs, and also that it's not a race to the bottom, that the, you know, they don't use this change as an excuse for those jobs to be, you know, yet another worse tier, that like those jobs should be up to par with existing standards. People want to restore cost of living increases across the board. That's another big one. You know, there's a lot that sort of people gave up when the employers were in hard times, but then when the employers went back to making money hand over fist, they didn't get it back.
I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. He's the co-host with me of Law and Disorder Radio, and we're speaking with Al Bradbury, the editor of Labor Notes. Al, the usual way that UAW and management start off negotiations is that they shake hands, and the president of the UAW, Sean Fain, wouldn't do that. It's a nice anecdote. Will you tell our listeners what happened?
Yes, I love this story. Instead of the photo op where the union leaders and the corporate leaders shake hands to kick off bargaining, UAW President Sean Fain and other leaders from the new administration went to the plants and instead spent the day shaking hands with auto workers, with the members of the union, talking with members and hearing their concerns and priorities for bargaining. So it's a wonderful, both real and symbolic move to show, yeah, they reflect the sea change in the approach in the union that this new leadership is taking. There's, I think all listeners probably all know the famous union song, "Which Side Are You On? Which Side Are You On?" And I think Fain and the UAW leaders are showing that they're on the member side for a change, that they're not on the boss's side, and they're not interested in, you know, making nice and civility with the boss, that they're really taking a more militant approach and willing to build to a strike, and a meaningful strike. As a UPS teamster said to me, that this year they were finally using the strike as a weapon against the boss and not the members. And that's the way it's been in the UAW, too, that there, you know, there have occasionally been strikes, but it's clear that the leadership is sort of letting the members let off steam by having a strike rather than setting out to organize a strike strategically to put pressure on the boss and win better. So this time it's clear the leadership of the union is on the workers' side and not the boss's side, and that if they do go on strike, it's going to be strategic and meant to extract gains and really to exert pressure on the big three.
Yeah, Al, I do want to ask you some more questions as well about all of this, but one of them in particular, I wanted you to talk about a bit more, was AI. You know, there are a number of social democracy countries around the world that are taking the step of training their workers who they know are going to be losing some jobs to AI for other kinds of work that they can meaningfully do. And I wonder if there's been any demands of that sort from the UAW as the auto manufacturers turn to electric cars. It will take apparently less workers on a line to make an electric car than a gas car. Is that a part of their demands at all, that some of the impacts of AI be planned for and taken care of by the manufacturers themselves or not?
I don't know about AI. I don't know the answer to that. I haven't heard of it coming up, but it may be. But certainly there are technological changes. There are changes in what the job entails with these electric plants. But there's also just you know, any kind of change. Employers will use an excuse to try to gain some ground. And the union wants to, you know, it's taking that head on and saying we don't, you know, these jobs should be union jobs. They should be subject to the same seniority. They should have the same rights and benefits.
What is a national contract campaign, and why is it effective, and how has it helped to shift the balance of power between workers and owners and employers?
A contract campaign is a campaign over a period of months, you know, leading up to bargaining, leading up to contract expiration, to get members involved and engaged, to build members' confidence and unity. And it's especially important when a union has been so inactive, hasn't had a powerful strike in a long time, hasn't had much member involvement. You got to build that muscle. You got to show it can be done. And unions do that in many ways. You can start with, often you'll start with milder things that are easy to participate in. Like the goal is, you know, you want wide participation. You start with something that's easy for everyone to do. Many unions will start with doing a bargaining survey, having meetings to talk about our priorities. What are the things we want to win this time around? You know, what do we want to change? What do we want to improve? And engaging coworkers in activities that get gradually more intense. Maybe everybody wears red on a certain day or wears a sticker or a button. You might have rallies off-site or on-site in the parking lot of your workplace or out on the street. You know, you keep turning up the heat. You might march on the boss to deliver a petition, whether it's about the bargaining topics or some specific issue in that workplace. Like, the idea of a contract campaign is you're, like, ramping up activity. And, you know, when you're getting close to a strike, you might be doing things like, in one union, people started hauling burn barrels to work in their truck. You know, just leaving it parked there in the parking lot to say, like, we're ready for a picket line. Or, you know, recently one auto worker was conspicuously stockpiling ramen inside the plant to show, like, if we have to occupy this place, you know, we got the food. So it's partly to show your coworkers and yourself that you're ready, to get ready, to sort of, you know, build that confidence and get in practice, get your communication networks going, figure out, is there an area of the workplace where people aren't participating and how do we get those people involved? You know, are there gaps in our network? And it's also to show the boss your power, that you're not bluffing. Like, if a strike is what's going to make them give you what you want, you don't want to just spring it on them, usually. You want them to see the strike threat a mile away, that it's coming, that it's serious, and it's getting closer and closer, and they should keep, you know, give you everything they've got in order to prevent it. Because, like, basically, right, your leverage is that at some point the boss is going to say, stop, either, you know, before you get to a strike or once you're on strike, that it's easy, you know, they'll decide it's easier or better for them to give you what you want and put this to an end than to keep it going. So these are organized steps. You know, in a national contract, you want to have a national leadership that's, like, encouraging this and setting a calendar and, you know, and sort of, like, inviting people to all march in the same direction. But it's also a thing that's actually going to be carried out by people, you know, in 1,000 different ways, in 1,000 different places around the country. And so you also don't want it to be totally stage managed. It's like, it's an opportunity for members' creativity and initiative to shine. And I think in both the auto workers and Teamsters UPS campaigns this year, we've seen lots of examples of people, you know, deciding, well, what we're going to do is we're going to have a meeting at a coffee shop, or we're going to organize a rally at a local park, or, like, here's a fun slogan that we could put on T-shirts, you know, sort of bringing their own initiative to it. The other thing I'll say is that many unions have nothing like a contract campaign. In both these unions, this was the first time in a long time that there was a serious contract campaign that, you know, that the union leadership was trying to lead. But, you know, there'd be little pockets of people trying to do it, but it's certainly more powerful if you're doing it together. And, you know, there are a lot of unions that haven't had a reform leadership, you know, yet organize and take over, where there isn't much activity. You might hear that there's going to be bargaining. You know, you might get some kind of an announcement about what they're going to do, but that there isn't a lot of consultation, there isn't a lot of information, you know, and maybe you find out at the end when they tell you, okay, we have the deal, we're going to vote on it. And that is such a squandering of power. If our power is our strength in numbers and our solidarity, then the way we're going to win the most is by everybody being involved and engaged, you know, as much as possible.
All right, Al, in the past, the contents of the negotiations between labor and management have often been kept secret from the union members themselves. This has changed in the UAW, hasn't it? Talk about the significance of this, please.
It absolutely has. Both the Teamsters and the UAW this year made big strides in, you know, actually communicating, you know, having an even two-way communication. So Sean Fain, the president of the UAW, has been on Facebook Live doing updates, talking about what's going on, but also, you know, taking people's comments in real time, talking about, hearing about people's concerns. He went on there with the Stellantis, the contract proposal from Stellantis, you know, formerly Chrysler, one of the big three, and said, I'm going to file this where it belongs and put it in the trash can there on screen, you know, which is a fun stunt, but also, like, reflects that he and the members are on the same page. They're, you know, in touch about, you know, what's being exchanged back and forth and what they're trying to get to.
Al Bradbury, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time. So before we have to say goodbye, could you please tell our listeners how people can contact Labor Notes and get involved?
Yeah, go to labornotes.org, where you can subscribe to our monthly magazine, sign up for our free email newsletter. We also have a lot of great books about how to organize, Troublemakers Union t-shirts, and we do a lot of trainings and events, both online and in person. So if you're a workplace activist who wants, you know, to get some guidance on how to organize or how to be a more effective steward or what to do when your union breaks your heart or how to connect racism in the labor movement. We have online trainings coming up and all of those things. And then a big conference with thousands of people coming together next April 19 to 21 in Chicago. So don't miss that. Labornotes.org for all of that.
Al Bradbury, it's been terrific speaking with you.
The labor is going to be very much in the press on the weeks and months ahead. And we're going to be coming back to you, I'm sure, to get your reaction to what we hear in the news.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been a treat.
Take it easy, Al.
Solidarity.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.